I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Mickey Bolt from the Alliance for American Manufacturing about some plant closures in the country and jobs. Really, how do we rebuild our manufacturing base? How do we make this country prosperous again? And I've been saying for years, the only way you have a viable nation is if you produce things. And I don't think there's much disagreement there. The question that I have is, now that we've got a rightward-leaning Congress with a whole bunch of Tea Party people in there, where do we fall on this stuff? We heard a lot of that rhetoric during the campaign, but as I'm seeing them put their congressional offices together, the new folks, it's filled with all of the same people. So will we see the same policies? Will we see the same lobbyists controlling our Congress? It's yet to be seen. So it'll be an interesting conversation with Mickey to see where he thinks manufacturing policy is going to go in the next couple of months, especially given the fact that this week the president is going to be meeting with the Chinese president, which we'll get into a little later. Also on the program, second hour, Cherie Follens, co-founder of Golf Challenge, a community-based organization in Grand Isle, Louisiana, talking about the According to the article on this woman, she's got a whole bunch of medical problems from the oil spill, and what they're doing down there to organize around getting health care for folks, children with lesions, all kind of bizarre things popping up, and who's looking out for them. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Today is Martin Luther King Day, and it's one of those days where, I focus on the labor accomplishments, on the fact that he walked with the sanitation workers and fought for their right to organize and to join and form unions for a better life. It doesn't, and again, this whole idea, black, white, green, purple, I don't care who's doing the job. It's got to be the kind of a job that pays a reasonable living wage, that families can be sustained on, that are local and encourage growth. Look, at the end of the day, I can fix our jobs problem in this country. I can get everybody a job tomorrow. Question is, will you be able to support yourself? And the answer is no. We learned during the Depression that we'll work for food. That wasn't even enough. That wasn't even low enough. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about today.
You know, Rick, he's one of the leading, I would say one of the most high profile individuals in the 20th century. Especially within the realm of civil rights. But I think what a lot of people don't know is that he was just a crusader for human rights and labor rights. And I don't think he gets enough credit. You always think of him as just in the realm of civil rights, but he did a lot more than just that. And I consider him one of the great men of the 20th century.
And that's why they have a day named after him. Anyway, today, back in 1961, President Eisenhower gave his farewell speech. And I thought this was kind of important, especially considering the budget problems we're having, the crisis that we're in. And I thought it was kind of interesting to think about that for a little bit. A couple of Eisenhower's famous quotes. I guess we're not going to hear that one. Is it there? Nope. Enough for that. How about this one? Nope, not again. Anyway, so we were going to play a couple of clips, but obviously those have broken. But anyway, he warned against the military-industrial complex. He warned against consumption for today. And the idea that we are going to spend and consume and make ourselves, you know, I guess, fat and happy. And the reason I thought that was going to be interesting because the Sentinel is running an interesting article on I-81. And if you go back and you understand 1954 was the Highway Act, the money that was put forth to build these roads, to connect the country together, to give us not only a 20th century road system, but a state-of-the-art 20th century road system. One where you could drive, you know, like the one guy said in the article, I can drive from, you know, the highway here to the airport in Washington and not have to stop at a light. It's that thing of the 1950s and early 60s that we look back on, and I do, and I see my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, they saw into the future. And what they saw into the future was investment, that thing that's going to be there for generations. And while the articles that the Sentinel put forth so far, that's a four-day series, this is the second day of it, I guess, what they put forth is, you know, this grand investment that people didn't think in this area was going to be as great as it is. It's expanded beyond the wildest imagination of some folks. And this is the kind of investment that I think we need to be talking about as we move forward instead of looking backward. You know, we need high-speed internet. We need broadband everywhere. We need high-speed rail. We need that investment that the Eisenhower generation looked forward and had vision and said, you know what? We need to build some for the future. We can use it today, but it will help us into the future. It will make us better than our competing nations. And I don't know that we have that vision anymore. And you can make the argument, and some do, that the only reason Eisenhower wanted this big highway system is to move missiles around. I don't believe that. That's the guise that they used to get it passed. But I think at the end of the road, they wanted to see the road system expand this country, to get into areas like this that would have never grown. And this article does a nice job of it. Now, look, the road has brought some problems. I mean, you have drug trafficking come through. You've got all of the problems that you have with large populations. But you would have never seen the economic growth and the prosperity that has come along with this. And, you know, they're still talking about widening the road again. Oh, we need to widen the road. It's going to cost X amount of dollars. If we don't do something like that now, in 10 years, 15 years, what is this road going to look like?
Well, in this country, I mean, thanks to the naysayers, we don't have adequate public transportation. So if we're not going to go after public transportation, high-speed rail, I mean, how do they expect the people of the United States, how to expect our commerce to get around the country? I mean, unless we're gonna expect the airline industry, which really isn't even capable in a small way of doing it. I mean, for our economic well-being, we're going to have the ability to get around the country, and we're going to have the ability of getting our goods and services around the country.
And that's one of the things they talk about in these articles, and I think it's worth going into a little bit, because, you know, you think about this area in general, would you have the economic growth? Would you have the factories? Would you have, the warehouses? Would you have all of this economic activity without that one investment? And that's why I think it's important to think about that this one investment has opened up all of these doors. And as we move forward and we start thinking about other investments, you know, I look at Wisconsin and Ohio, this idea that they don't want to put this rail line through that is going to, one, create jobs on the short term. You are going to put people back to work right now at a time when you absolutely need it the most. And those jobs are going to spring up communities all around the rail line. You're going to get high density developments. You're going to have high density living all around those rail stops. As we've done in past generations, this is not rocket science. You know, I'm a dumb truck driver. I can see it. Look, at the end of the road, if we're not building something that is going to be here for our children and that they can bank on, they're going to do it somewhere else. And I look at what the Chinese are doing. I think the Chinese are doing all the right things. I think they're the smart ones in all this. They're using our money to do it, which is even smarter yet. And I question our resolve. I question our intelligence in this. And maybe, you know, and I've had some conversations with folks lately who have been, you know, very high on the Tea Party people taking over because, you know, they ran on a platform that they were going to be pro-American trade. I would be interested to see what would happen if we put forth a Buy American provision in any bill going forward. How many of those folks we would get? I'm really kind of interested in that. And I would love to see someone do that because it's important that we start talking about how do we make ourselves more competitive? How do we grow our own economy? How do we invest in our future? How do we get off the oil? How do we get off of all of our foreign dependence? I think it starts by building at home. You know, if you're going to put solar panels at the local school, maybe those solar panels should be built here. Maybe we shouldn't allow dumping of cheaper foreign goods. Maybe we shouldn't because it's not good for us. And I look at that situation up in Massachusetts, where they spent millions of dollars to build this facility to employ 800 folks. And what ended up happening? They couldn't compete. So they closed the doors. Now, I see the reason they probably couldn't compete is because we weren't buying them from them. You know, if we were buying them as the federal government, the state government, local governments, whatever, to put on our schools, to put on our federal buildings, they would have thrived. And the price probably would have come down because you'd be producing more of them. And it would have gotten the consumer market started. People like me who want to put solar panels on my house would do it. But if you can't compete with things that are being dumped in here, you have no industry. And if you have no industry, you're dependent on someone else. And the sad reality is we have become far too dependent. Far too dependent on the Chinese.
Absolutely. Greg, if I can comment on what you said about the Tea Party people, you know, it's going to be very interesting on some key issues. Are they really going to be true to what they preached? You know, are they going to oppose earmarks? Are they going to vote for something that you talked about, Buy American provisions? Or are they going to succumb to the system? You know how the system works. You know, if you're not loyal to the leadership can withhold goodies. It'll be very, very interesting to see what's going to come out of that. And I'm optimistic. I'm like you. I'm going to wait and see. I think perhaps some of them will stand by what they said, and some of that could be beneficial to our side on this, you know, in the next Congress.
Well, we shall soon see. Because I got to be honest, what I'm seeing. I'm seeing them hiring the same old folks.
Well, the proof is in the pudding. We'll wait till they come down to some crucial votes.
Yeah, the same old Washington folks. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Mickey Boltz from the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Writers Guild of America East scored two victories last week when it won National Labor Relations Board organizing elections. nonfiction writers and producers at Atlas Media and ITV Studios voted in favor of union representation. Organizing writers and producers for production companies can be a difficult endeavor due to many of the jobs being freelance or temporary. WGA East Executive Director Lowell Peterson spoke with the Workers Independent News on Friday to explain how such organizing drives are unique.
In this case, people are temporary at particular shops but tend to stay in the industry. So communicating with them is not so difficult as it might be in some other industries. You know, it's a large and flexible pool of people, but it's basically a defined pool of people. It's several hundred folks in New York City in particular, and there's some folks in other cities as well. But the other thing is we have, when we've done these NLRB elections, we've won the right to have people who are not currently employed at the particular shop vote in the election. If you've worked at the shop for a certain number of weeks, in some cases a lot of weeks, prior to the election, you're eligible to vote. And that is a recognition that we had to fight for, but that is a recognition that people do cycle through. And if you might work for an ITV in January and then not work for them for 6 months and then work for them again, and you have just as much interest in whether ITV people are unionized as someone who happens to be sitting at the desk today.
We will remember Dr. King and his dream, keeping it alive. It's about social and economic justice.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life while helping public sanitation workers in their struggle for union rights and dignity on the job. In Cincinnati Friday, hundreds of labor and community activists honored Dr. King's legacy in a candlelight gathering condemning Ohio Governor John Kasich's plan to strip child care and home health care workers of their rights to collectively bargain. AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker was at the Cincinnati event.
The real issue is we've got to put our people back to work. With 15 million people unemployed in this country and wanting to work, that should be the priority. But instead, we have these elected officials who have been elected with Wall Street money, who are out there preaching on behalf of Wall Street, but not caring a darn about Main Street.
Holt-Baker says public workers are under assault nationwide, despite the fact that Wall Street, not workers, are to blame for the economic stress of state budget deficits.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by ULICO and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. It's Manufacturing Monday.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. This week, the president of China is coming to visit, and trade has to be on the table. For me, it's about how do we come up with policies that are going to benefit you and me. I would love to have the agreement that the Chinese get from us. I would love to be able to do the things that they get away with here. How do we stop it? That's why I've asked Mickey Boltz. He's from the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org. Mickey, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. I'm honored to be on here, so thank you.
I appreciate you taking time for me. You know, as I look at this meeting with the president of China, I got to think that trade has got to be on the table.
Well, we know that's one of the things we always try to put on the table. China always tries to keep that kind of off the table because they want us to talk about issues that they think we should be interested in, about Korea and also the U.N. sanctions with Iran, about trying to make sure they don't get the atomic bomb. But the people that are trading the most with Iran is China themselves. So they make us capitulate and kind of give up our trading sense just to try to get China to obey the international rules on these two rogue nations.
you know, I look at the new Congress coming into power, and I look at some of the folks that ran, and I'm hopeful. There's part of me that's hopeful that the new Tea Party people are going to be, at least on my side when it comes to trade, and I think on your side as well. Hopefully we'll see some sanity, maybe. Thoughts?
Well, that's what we're hoping also, because at least when these people were running, when we had the Republicans running, they also were talking. We hear both sides saying, we've got to get people back to work. We've got to make it in America again. And this is very important. And we're hoping that it just wasn't rhetoric from the new Congress coming in. And we're going to find out. We're going to be going down there to talk to them and try to discuss different laws in that to see where they actually stand.
You know,
we're hoping on that agenda they do. They're right with us. They're right with the working people.
Well, I'm hopeful. But the only thing I keep hearing is that, well, you know, we need more of the same. More tax cuts, more deregulation, more of the things that I think got us into this mess, and not a national strategy on how do we protect our manufacturers. Other countries are protecting theirs. How do we help ours?
Well, you're absolutely right, Rick, because if you look at the two nations that have kind of this you know, this economic quandrum that we got into a few years ago, and that was China, because they undercut, they cheat on our trade laws and everything else, but also Germany. And Germany is a place that their workers are paid a very decent wage and everything else. But the reason why they came out of the economic recession so well is because their government plans to how to protect it and to grow their manufacturing base. And it's worked extremely well for them. But I'm just afraid that if we talk about doing that here, they worry that that might be too much government control, and we may not get it. But that's what we need.
Well, we absolutely need a plan. I mean, you know, you can have the best football players in the world. If they're not on the same page, you're not going to score a touchdown.
Exactly. We've seen that so many times, especially the team I cheer for. But of course, I don't know if they're the best team in the world, but they don't have a plan. They don't know what's going on. And we see that with a lot of, you know, our different sports franchise. And we sit there and see them and wonder, what in the world are they doing? They seem to change their mind every 2 or 3 years and change everything. Well, we're doing that with the country. You know, we started talking a few years ago that we wanted to be number one in the world in green technology. Well, if we go back to the early 80s, where we went and, like, developed the industry for wind turbines and everything else. And because of our trade practices and everything else, we've given that industry away to China. And it's been horrible. I mean, our tax dollars actually built and did all the research and development for that industry. And because of our trade policies, we've basically given it away.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, you know, we had put so much money in the late 70s, because, you know, Carter pursued an energy policy for the first time, an energy policy that would have gotten us off foreign oil. And we've talked about this on the program a number of times. In comes Reagan in 1981, rips out the solar panels that President Carter put in and got us back on the juice, got us hooked back on the drug that we were trying to get off of.
Right. And we've done this back and forth. I mean, we saw Bush try to get us, and he connected us right back to the big oil that we had. We're connected to them. We made very little steps to get off of that during those 8 years, which we should have been doing, which would have been great for our future with the, you know, the greenhouse gases and everything else. But it didn't happen. And
you know, here's the thing. Every day, I'm reading in the newspaper, we're losing jobs, we're losing another industry, often. And I'm, at some point, either we're going to run out of stuff to lose, or we're going to wake up. At least I hope.
I haven't, you know, we used to call China the great sleeping giant, but, you know, you're right. When it comes to this stuff, we're the ones that are sleeping. We're the ones losing our industry left and right to the overseas market, mainly to China. It's not that, you know, that China's doing anything bad, which they are. I mean, they are. But the bad thing is we are not enforcing our trade rules. We're letting them subsidize their industries, you know, and manipulate their currency so that they get a huge price advantage here.
It's amazing stuff. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Mickey Bolt from the Alliance for American Manufacturing, their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. A little earlier we were talking about a factory out your way that I guess is closing. We've given, the state aid has given some money to them, and they're closing anyway, I guess. Is that right?
Well, it's strange. We're not sure what's going to happen. This story just broke Wednesday afternoon late. And they're still, we're not sure what's going on. It's sort of like they may grab whatever deal they could get from the exiting governor, Ed Rendell. And who knows what's going to happen when Corbett comes in, because he may not sign the check. But Reznor Heater, that's been in Mercer County, Pennsylvania, since like 1850 or 1830. They make the large heaters that you'll find at like garages. You know, where they may have three or four bays for trucks or so, and you'll see a heater up on the roof, up on the ceiling, and a lot of times that's a Reznor heater. Well, they decided that their building was too old and to modernize or whatever. I don't know. The county commissioners worked with them, and they came up with a deal that they're going to get $2.5 million from the state, and that's going to allow them to tear down their factory. They're going to ship the remaining jobs, 100 or so, either to probably Mexico, but some may go to their other non-union plant in Mississippi, and then build a 6,000-square-foot research and development place. And that money also is going to, that we get from the state, is also supposed to help some with training. I don't know how much. But I just, you know, there was no, and they are going to save some jobs that are going to stay here. I think they're talking about 50 or 40 jobs of the whole deal.
And we're going to give a couple of $1 million to save those. You know, and this is, I got to be honest, there's part of me that says, you know, we've got to stop this beggar thy neighbor economic development, where we're giving these companies who are going to leave anyway, you know, big handouts, big awards.
I agree with that, and I think, you know, give them money to tear down their factory that they have here, and so they don't have to pay property tax on that and everything else. That's a heck of a subsidy we're giving to a company, and I'd like to see them get something more in return, more than just a 6,000-square-foot research and development factory or facility, which actually they could shut that down easily and move that also. It really does not make a whole lot of business sense to have your R&D facility, you know, 3,000 miles away from where you're actually producing the goods. So I don't know if they got any kind of commitment to leave it there for so long or not, but it just doesn't make sense.
But, you know, again, you know, I go back to this conservative mantra, the invisible hand. We're just going to allow things to happen, and whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of having a good plan, that it makes sense. So so that is something that just broke and we're working with, and hopefully we'll get that resolved, that it will actually bring more jobs here, but as of now it isn't. They were looking at one time about a year and a half ago, this Reznor company was owned by Thomas and Betts, made the statement that they were actually going to bring some of the lines back from Mexico. They moved them out 15 years ago, but they said the factory was too small. And they then proceeded to go through the county and look at all the facilities that they could use, but they always found something wrong with it. Oh, there's not city water. And everybody said, we'll run a line of city water out to you instead of the well water. Never mind. And, you know, they just moved around from site to site and found something wrong with it, and then things got quiet. We think that was just window dressing, that they were just trying to leave anyway, and they put up a, you know, what looked like a good faith effort to look for someplace.
No, what it is they're parsing their bets. They're, you know, seeing who could give them the best deal.
Well, exactly.
You know, I look here locally. You know, there's a company that's been in this area 93 years, Carlisle Tire and Wheel. They got like $34 million to move to Tennessee. You think they stayed? No. The state of Pennsylvania, the local development council, they tried to give, I think they came up with like 15, wasn't enough. And until we as a nation stop this. And I've asked Congress people if there's a way to stop this stuff, because it's ridiculous that we're beating each other up. State to state, we're beating each other up even before we go to the global marketplace, even before we go to compete with the Russians. We're beating each other up from Pennsylvania to Kentucky.
Right. And we see that. I mean, we're right on the Ohio border, and we see that all the time, because Ohio, they pay out far less for unemployment insurance than Pennsylvania does. So if you're laid off in Ohio, you make less money per week than you will in Pennsylvania. But because of it, they pay in less. And many of the laws are different, so it's actually cheaper for them to operate right across the line in Ohio. And, and you got states and counties that are trying to steal businesses from each other, and they go over there and spend their 7 years for the tax abatement, and then they run back, let's make a deal every 7 or 8 years. And that's not how to actually grow manufacturing or employment in this country.
Yeah, which is why, I've said, I think under the Commerce Clause, you could stop that. You could stop states from beggaring thy neighbor. You could stop them from doing it. And it makes sense because, again, like I said, we're beating each other up even before we get into the global arena. I mean, if you had a boxer who walked down the main hallway to the ring, and every guy on the way got to punch him in the face, what kind of shape do you think he'd get into in the ring? Not very good.
Well, you're right. But, Rick, you're absolutely right on that. But they haven't stopped it because the local politicians get good PR out of this. Oh, look, we just attracted this place from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and they've been a good, worker employer there for all these years. They're going to be great here, So the local politicians get a lot of good PR, and some of the state ones. So it's hard for them to change that. But you're right. We need leadership from above.
I absolutely
agree. And we haven't.
I had one politician tell me, just what you said, that they get all this good PR. Look what we brought to your area. He said what they should probably have to make them do, make that guy then go back to the community that they stole the jobs from and explain to them why.
Yes.
And see what kind of PR they got there.
Exactly. So, but that's just the way we do things in this country. We operate and run manufacturing like that. We build these enterprise zones, or whatever you want to call them, keystone places, and they have tax abatements, and we steal businesses from one place to another. We think we're growing things, but we're really not.
We're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
That's all we're doing.
I grew up in Cleveland, home of the we'll give you tax abatement and free energy and free water and free everything. Just bring your company here. Cleveland at one time had the fifth highest number of Fortune 500 companies within its borders. But they weren't paying any taxes. And look where the city's in now. And you've been to Cleveland a number of times. The city's in trouble.
It is in trouble. And the thing I couldn't believe, they were talking at the beginning of this year that if they don't get the money for education from the Obama stimulus package, that they were looking at class size of at least 50 students per class.
Yep.
Because they don't have money for teachers. And this is wrong. So wrong.
But it is the direction we're heading.
The way we go around it is, put people back to work, start making it here.
Yeah, I've said there's no crisis, there's no policy problem that we can't solve when people are employed. And to me, the Obama administration dropped the ball. The first thing they should have done before health care, before anything, get people back to work, even if you had to start a program where government is the employer of last resort.
I agree with that, and they could have had a master plan. They could have used the stimulus package, which did help, but it was way too small, because when you look at all the tax cuts, and they gave the tax cuts out for local people, for people to use, and I used it too, and they found out a lot of people, even paid back the banks on what they owed, and those are the people that started the whole problem to begin with, where they went to Walmart and bought toasters and things like that, which stimulated the Chinese economy when it really didn't. The tax cuts didn't stimulate our economy.
Yeah, exactly. And what I said should have happened is we shouldn't have given out tax breaks. We should have just built stuff. That's what we should have done. Like all the roads and the bridges that are crumbling. That would have been a good start.
And
today,
there's so much of that they could have. They did a lot with what little they had, but we could have done a whole lot more.
We sure could have. And, you know, you think today was the day Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex and not spending beyond your means. You know, the guy who brought us the highway system in this country.
Yes. And it's amazing to me. And I'm just reading a book about this, our country and how it produced wealth. And, you know, we could take dirt and turn it into gold with our manufacturing process. We've done that. And, you know, they talked about New York State, how that was being bypassed, and then they sat down and spent the money for an infrastructure project called the Erie Canal that connected Lake Erie to the Hudson River. And it was a boom for New York State.
Yep.
And everybody kept saying, you can't afford that. You can't afford it. And it was a huge thing that the state undertook all by themselves. And it made that state very, very rich.
And the other part of that is that you can't afford it, but can you afford not to?
Exactly.
And that's where we are now.
That's what I think, too. But we can't get any kind of plan, any kind of thought in the future. We just got to run willy-nilly from one thing to another. And the way our trade laws are, we got to take the Chinese on every individual case.
Absolutely.
And we needed that bill about the currency manipulation that would say, you know, if you don't stop manipulating the currency, let it float on the open market like every other country does. If not, we'll slap a tariff on every good you have in here, coming in here.
I'm right there with you, Mickey. Mickey Bolt from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. The website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Mickey, I appreciate your time. Great talking to you, and I look forward to having you back again real soon.
I appreciate that, too, Rick. You're doing a great job. Keep it up.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Drowning in craft lies. Save the USA and resume the taxes fine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You know you're in trouble when you're reduced to calling Dennis Hastert as a character witness. After all, when he was Speaker of the U.S. House, Hastert ran the place as a pay-to-play whorehouse, openly trading legislative favors for the campaign cash waved around by frisky corporate lobbyists. Who in the world would want Hastert to vouch for their ethical virtue? Tom DeLay, the former GOP majority leader and the one Congress critter who was even sleazier. Having been convicted last fall by a Texas jury for illegally laundering corporate money into some state legislative races, DeLay was back in the courthouse on January 10th for sentencing. Was Tom respectfully repentant? Come on, does a skunk smell its own stink? No, nothing is ever his fault. Even though he had also been reprimanded by his own colleagues for schmoozing with favor-seeking lobbyists and for commandeering a federal agency in one of his partisan actions against Democrats, he dismissed that comeuppance as nothing but, quote, a warning ticket. Bad metaphor, since he clearly sped right through the warning. Now a convicted felon, DeLay blames Democrats for his, quote, persecution, even though the jury that found him guilty included Republicans and independents. At his sentencing, the closest he got to expressing contrition about his corruption was to admit that sometimes he comes off as arrogant. However, he even denied that his arrogance was bad, quickly explaining to the judge, I like to think of it as Texas cocky. How about Texas stupid? This is Jim Hightower saying the judge was not amused by DeLay's insistence that he is the victim. Before there were Republicans and Democrats, the judge said, there was America, and what America is about, the rule of law. Pointedly noting that, I agree with the jury's verdict, the judge then sentenced Clueless Tom to 3 years in state prison and 10 years of probation. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit Hightower Lowdown.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody, everybody, let's get into it. Get stoned, come on. Get it started, come on. Get it started.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, right there at thericksmithshow.com for your convenience. You can download it to your pod, to your iPod, or just download it to your computer. Watch the video right there as well. Tomorrow, President Obama and Chinese leader Xi, they are going to meet for the first time. But on Friday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave a major policy speech on China-U.S. relations. In her speech, she focused on the need for mutual cooperation, not only on the issues that they agree on, but, of course, the divisive ones as well, you know, like trade, you know, like security, human rights, Iran, North Korea, Taiwan, you know, that stuff, the important stuff. She said, moving forward, it is up to both of us to more consistently translate positive words into effective cooperation. It is up to both of us to deal with our differences, and we need to deal with them wisely and responsibly. And it is up to both of us to meet our respective global responsibilities and obligations. Hillary, in an attempt to address the growing concern, like people like me, in looking at the Chinese military and their modernization, their increasingly assertiveness when it comes to foreign policy, and their resurgent nationalism, said some in the region and some here at home see China's growth as a threat that will lead to either Cold War-style conflict or American decline. She went on to say, and some in China worry that the United States is bent on containing China's rise and constraining China's growth. She said, we reject those views. In the 21st century, it does not make sense to apply zero-sum 19th century theories to how major powers interact. It's going to be interesting to see where this goes with the president, because there are several things that happened in 2010 that I think have kind of strained relations. You look at the arms sale that we sold the Taiwanese government arms. You look at North Korea, the fact that the Chinese haven't come out and condemn them for sinking the South Korean ship, not to mention the relationship that's going on there with Japan and some of our other allies over territorial claims. I'm interested to see how this stuff's gonna fall out. Now, we're not gonna get all the news, but it'll be interesting to see the chess match that goes on. You know, how are the Chinese going to be reacting to being pushed on North Korea? I mean, we talk about trade, we talk about, you know, how it affects our jobs, but we've pulled China into the 21st century, or into the 20th century. They're going to surpass us very shortly with our money and with our technology. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Well, isn't it true, Rick, that I think you mentioned North Korea. I mean, isn't it true that, you know, that problem we had with them? The Chinese really didn't want to upset the apple cart. I mean, they didn't want to hurt their own economic self-interest, which could have happened depending on what the North Koreans did. So, you know, I think that was a move that helped both countries. I'm not so sure that'll be a negative. I think China did what they felt they had to do. And it was a pragmatic move, and it helped us, obviously, and it helped China.
It helped China by staying out of it and not taking a position. That helped us with North Korea?
Well, I think it did. I mean, I don't think they gave the message to North Korea that anything goes. And I think they were kind of, I think they were deliberately standing off. I think they were sending them a message, look, you know, you don't want to escalate. But we shall see.
Yeah, we'll see. Also, human rights records have recently shown that China has, again, not a very good record. It's not a very good one. Hillary called for more freedoms for the people of China, as well as the release of several political prisoners. And the thing is, Obama's going to want to look good in here, because the globe is finally looking to the U.S. As someone of a better stature. They're finally looking elsewhere for someone to hate, I think, after 8 years of George W. Bush. So he's going to want to look powerful on the international stage, but also, I think, cooperate. I think it's going to be interesting. I really am. I'm interested to see how the next couple of days are going to play out. This will have a lot to do with his presidency and the legacy that he's going to have in the next 2 years. What goes on with China? Because we cannot continue down the same path. We cannot allow them to eat our lunch. We can't allow them to eat our manufacturing base and steal the wealth. Now, you know, the business community, they're all happy. And I don't understand it. Maybe somebody can explain this to me, because I'm not getting it. I'm not getting the idea that we can just allow our manufacturing base to be eviscerated and to be broken up and taken elsewhere, and us left with, well, nothing except cheaper products. And cheap products are great when you've got money. But if you have, like we have, 15 million unemployed and everybody else with declining wages and declining benefits, I'm not quite sure that cheap products are enough. Not quite sure about that. One of the other words that Hillary used that I thought was interesting, she used the word entanglement in her speech regarding trading partners. And, you know, I stop and I think back, George Washington warned about staying clear of foreign entanglements. On the military front, but I'm looking at all of this and how dependent, interdependent we are with the Chinese. And I got to wonder, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the founding fathers. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, what would the founders do? I don't quite think they would have gotten us into this mess. I think they would have traded, of course. But I don't think it would have been this lopsided. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and Commerce Secretary Gary Locke called for faster appreciation of China's undervalued currency and further opening up of the Chinese markets. Because, you know, here again, the argument on one side is that, well, all we have to do is we have to open up their markets to our goods and make them value their currency. What about the cheap labor? What about the environment? What about those things? I mean, again, you know, it's like the Teamsters who make the argument that, you know, the only reason that they don't want Mexican drivers on American roads is because they're unsafe. What happens if you put all brand new trucks out? Then what? Then the argument's gone. For me, these are both economic issues. And the economic issue on this is, you know, you're still talking about workers who are making 20 to 50 cents an hour compared to folks here who are making considerably more. Can we compete with that? Some say we can. I don't think we can. I don't think you're ever going to be able to compete with somebody who's allowed to pollute and violate labor laws and do the things that they do there. Just don't think it's going to happen. But here again, we shall move forward and we shall see. When we come back, I want to talk about the solar plant up in Massachusetts that just is closing down and a little bit about that. We're going to take a quick break. We're back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make red light.
bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, that appears to be what's going on up in Devens, Massachusetts, as the Evergreen Solar Company closes its doors, affecting some 800 northern central Massachusetts workers. Now, look, you know, what they've done is they've opened up their plant there in China, from what I understand. They're still going to be producing just in China. Now, you look at the money that was spent. The state of Massachusetts came up with about $58 million in tax grants, state grants, tax incentives, loans. Here's a whole bunch of money. And now they're closing down. And for me, it comes back down to this idea that, and I wish we would have done it. I wish as a nation we would have said, you know what, we need an energy policy that's going to encourage, not as George W. Bush said, consumption, but conservation and smart production. And, you know, I don't think I can talk enough about the school district that I live in putting solar panels on the one school, taking that school completely off the grid. $1 million investment is going to pay dividends for years into the future, not to mention save on electric bills right now. But beyond saving on the bills, it's going to save on the need to produce that energy, which means the grid won't be as taxed, which means that maybe we won't burn as much coal, which means we won't probably have to blow off another mountaintop, which means we won't probably have to pollute another river. There's a lot that goes into this. And for me, if we were thinking this way, if we were thinking about, gee, you know, how could we produce more energy? How could we make every home energy independent? And we have the technology. We've had the technology for years. Problem is we just don't have leaders with vision. We don't have people who've got the stones to stand up. You know what? From this point forward, every new home that's built, it's going to be energy independent. It'll be off the grid. But we don't have that kind of, that kind of stones. We just don't have those people who have the vision for it. And I look at somebody like Sean Hannity, and I generally hate talking about other talk show hosts. But he said something to me that said something here that just to me really just epitomizes ignorant. Listen to this clip.
Two things I said. I said, why isn't Iraq paying us back with oil and paying every American family and their soldiers that lost loved ones or have injured soldiers? And why didn't they pay for their own liberation? For the Kuwait oil minister, how short his memory is. Mm-hmm. You know, we have every right to go in there and, frankly, take all their oil and make them pay for the liberation.
So I hear that. And number one, the Iraq people didn't want us there. So this idea that we're some, and this is in his mind, I think, that for some reason the Iraqis asked us to come there, and we were there because we were asked. No, we weren't asked to be there. So this idea that somehow they're going to pay us back for going in and bombing them back into the 18th century, I don't really think that's viable. And as far as Kuwait, really? You should have been complaining about that from 1991 forward, I would think. Or am I missing something here?
You're right on, right?
And this idea that, oh, everyone should, you know, give to us this oil. No. What we need to do is we need to get out of that sandbox. We need to get off the juice. We need to figure out how to go through rehab. Maybe put down the needle. You know, you had an entire party who ran on drill, baby, drill. And what did it get us? It got us thousands of people sick in the Gulf. It got us a spill of we still don't know what's going to happen because of that deep water horizon spill. We have no idea what the long-term effects are going to be. Even though they keep telling us, don't worry about it, everything's fine. We can have these environmental disasters, and somehow the planet will just heal itself. It's like here, we're talking about the natural gas. The drillers drilling here for gas. Oh, you know, we can do it in a safe way, but everybody you talk to, they got a horror story. And we haven't even ramped up yet
It hasn't even really started. There's some stuff going on, but it has not gone full tilt. When it does, we got problems.
What's even more amazing, we mentioned Jimmy Carter before, but I have to mention it again. I mean, when you're talking about Sean Hannity, I've caught him several times. I mean, literally mocking Jimmy Carter as if he's this old man who really doesn't, whose day is past, who was a horrible president, who was incompetent. But yet the truth is, if we would have followed Jimmy Carter's advice, we'd be a much better nation today. And I still think it was only because of the negative impact on the economy when the Arabs turned the oil spigot off that he isn't president today. And think how different this country would be if Jimmy Carter would have been elected to a second term.
Yeah, I don't think he'd be president today, but...
Well, he wouldn't be president today, but right. the nation would certainly
right.
have gone a different route. And they would have...
Oh, we most certainly would have.
And we would have embraced his concept of conservation and alternate energy sources. Think how far along the way we'd be from energy independence.
Well, we created all of this technology back then. And the Chinese and the Germans and the French, they took it forward.
Crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
You know, he went on to say that we're gonna cut by 20%. We're gonna cut our oil usage by 20%. And you know what that 20% number was? That was the number that we were getting from the Middle East. We would have, had we followed that, we wouldn't. I don't think we would have the problems we had over there, because we could tell them, go pound sand.
And do you remember the other reason he lost, Rick? Do you remember that?
Well, the helicopters.
And there's some clear evidence that the Reagan administration was involved in deliberately keeping those captors until after the election. They negotiated with the Khomeini regime.
I actually had a friend. And, you know, this is one of those, I know a friend who knows a guy, but I had a friend who, he had a relative who was killed in Hawaii on leave, who was a helicopter mechanic. And I don't think I've ever told this before, but he was specifically ordered at the time to remove some filter so that it would run quietly. And it sounds like hocus pocus to me. But according to this guy that I worked with, they took the filters off and, you know, the engine clogged up with sand and boom, down they went. And I've actually read that in a couple of places, which is surprising. I sure hope that's not the truth. Anyway, but you go back to that time period. Had we just followed some simple movement forward and kept the tax credits that people used, maybe we wouldn't see the mess that we're seeing in the Gulf and the horrible effects that are going on to people. I read a story today, the woman we're going to talk to here in a second, ethyl benzene levels 2.5 times that of the 95th percentile. Babies with lesions and children with lesions all over their body and all of these horrible things that have come out of this. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Cherie Foytlin from the group Gulf Change. So stick around. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The Writers Guild of America East scored two victories last week when it won National Labor Relations Board organizing elections. Nonfiction writers and producers at Atlas Media and ITV Studios voted in favor of union representation. Organizing writers and producers for production companies can be a difficult endeavor due to many of the jobs being freelance or temporary. WGA East Executive Director Lowell Peterson spoke with the Workers Independent News on Friday to explain how such organizing drives are unique.
In this case, people are temporary at particular shops but tend to stay in the industry. So communicating with them is not so difficult as it might be in some other industries. You know, it's a large and flexible pool of people, but it's basically a defined pool of people. It's several hundred folks in New York City in particular, and there's some folks in other cities as well. But the other thing is we have, when we've done these NLRB elections, we've won the right to have people who are not currently employed at the particular shop vote in the election. If you've worked at the shop for a certain number of weeks, in some cases a lot of weeks, prior to the election, you're eligible to vote. And that is a recognition that we had to fight for, but that is a recognition that people do cycle through. And if you might work for an ITV in January and then not work for them for 6 months and then work for them again, and you have just as much interest in whether ITV people are unionized as someone who happens to be sitting at the desk today.
We will remember Dr. King and his dream, keeping it alive. It's about social and economic justice.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life while helping public sanitation workers in their struggle for union rights and dignity on the job. In Cincinnati Friday, hundreds of labor and community activists honored Dr. King's legacy in a candlelight gathering condemning Ohio Governor John Kasich's plan to strip child care and home health care workers of their rights to collectively bargain. AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker was at the Cincinnati event.
The real issue is we've got to put our people back to work. With 15 million people unemployed in this country and wanting to work, that should be the priority. But instead, we have these elected officials who have been elected with Wall Street's money, who are out there preaching on behalf of Wall Street, but not caring a darn about Main Street.
Holt-Baker says public workers are under assault nationwide, despite the fact that Wall Street, not workers, are to blame for the economic stress of state budget deficits.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show. You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say
revolution starts now. Think it's time for change. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. The National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill held a meeting last week, and out of that meeting came some interesting and disturbing stories. One was that of Cherie Foytlin, who told the commission that her ethyl benzene levels were 2.5 times that of the normal level. Cherie is the co-founder of Gulf Change, a community organization based in Grand Isle, Louisiana. Cherie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, I look at this spill and I'm trying to explain to people that, you know, our addiction to oil has caused us a whole bunch of trouble.
Well, I agree. And I've always preached that it really comes down to self-responsibility. From the very beginning, we were out there when the oil first started coming in. And honestly, I just felt so much grief myself. And my husband works in the oil industry. He works in the deep water rigs, but it wasn't because of that. It was because of just knowing as a people and a culture all that we've wasted and all the things that we use and throw away and have lost, and just it's just greed. And if we don't come down to ourselves and self-responsibility, because it's going to have to change on a personal level. That's the fundamental root of all of this.
Now, I absolutely agree with you. You know, and I look at your story, this ethyl benzene level. Can you explain to me what that is?
Well, I'm not a scientist by any means. In fact, I'm a mother of six and, like I said, the wife of an oil worker. But what happened was we went down for the beginning and documented a spill. I'm also a journalist with a small paper here in South Louisiana. And we were around the dispersants, the Corexit mixing with the oil, from my understanding, made it six times more toxic. Okay, so these polyaromatic hydrocarbons are in our systems now. And ethyl benzene is just basically the breaking down of benzene within our bloodstream. Now, there was other, there were out of 10 possible carbons that could be in a human, I tested for six of them. But the ethyl benzene was the highest. And the ethyl benzene causes leukemia, breast cancers. It can cause sterilization. It can cause deformities in babies. We have people on the Gulf right now that are dealing with staph infections. I've seen very small children with staph infections all down their legs. The CDC is not on the ground anymore and hasn't been since September, and we haven't been able to get the national news to pay any attention. We have headaches. People are nauseated, diarrhea, rectal bleeding, bleeding through the ears. There's hemorrhaging, bruising. We're not, and the thing about it is you can't sit there and just, I can run down a list of symptoms, but some people may have a few of those symptoms, and some people may have all of them, and some people may have a few others, because basically it comes down to individually we're different people, and chemically we're different, and those reactions with those chemicals, from my understanding, react differently in different people. So the worst part is our doctors, who, by the way, we have very few down here, very, very few know anything about chemical exposure. So we have no one to go to.
And you're getting no help from the, because, you know, for me, I'm looking at this and, you know, for the most part, this isn't something that's talked about up here in the North. It's not something that's on the evening news. So most people have now forgotten. It's out of sight. It's out of mind. But you guys are still going to have to live with this mess down there. And you're getting no help from the CDC whatsoever?
No, the CDC is not on the ground. Now, poison control is taking.
No, that's the end of that. Yeah, and I look at this, and I'm looking at this, and I think we lost Cherie, and we'll get her back on the line here in a second. But, you know, I'm looking at this spill, and what interesting to me is that, you know, it's out of the mainstream, it's out of the it's not on the evening news. We're not seeing this massive gusher in the Gulf, so we've forgotten it. And, you know, they pulled the booms in, and, you know, the dispersant she was talking about. To me, I think we put those in solely so you wouldn't see it, so that they could disperse it underwater and it wouldn't come up to the surface. Where I'm told, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm told that had we allowed that stuff to come to the surface, we would have been able to capture a lot more of it, and it would have been less of an environmental disaster had we just been able to capture it. But we couldn't have all of that oil coming to the surface. We just couldn't do it. So they used this dispersant to hide what was spewing into the water, and now you've got people who are sick. People like Cherie Foytlin. Cherie, I don't know what happened, but thanks for coming back.
I'm back.
You know, I'm talking about this dispersant that you had mentioned, and it's my thought, and I'd love your opinion. The only reason they used this stuff was so that we wouldn't see it coming to the surface. That they could disperse it underwater, we wouldn't see it on the surface. There would be no pictures.
No, I 100% agree. And when I spoke at the Oil Spill Commission, Francis Beinecke was there and Donald Besh, and he said, and they both said, that it was a trade-off. It was a trade-off because they didn't want it to come into the marshes. Well, I'm here to tell you, I was there from the beginning, and it was already up in the marshes. When I was down there, I was on a boat with Governor Jindal, and with Billy Nungesser, the Pikeman's Parish president, and the media, and it was already like miles in the marsh, and they were complaining because of the berm situation and all that. I'm sure you guys have heard of, but my point is, you're absolutely right, because it looked horrible, and it would have continued to look horrible and nasty, but I think that it would have broken down eventually, and nature would have taken care of itself. But by using this dispersant, they settled it all to the bottom, and it's all down there. Well, it's cold weather, now. It's our winter, which isn't nearly as bad as yours, but it still gets cold. But the Gulf turns over, just like any lake, and now we've got oil just coming in, and it looks like fresh oil. I don't know if it is, but I do know that there's tar mats, not tar balls, tar mats that are miles long that are coming in now in Grand Isle, Venice, Alabama, Florida, Mississippi. I've been in every state. I've seen it on every beach, and it's so far up in the marsh now that most of the marsh that was already eroding into the sea is just dead. And I mean, there's no insects, there's no animals. When you go out there, it's deafening silence. It's dead.
That's horrible. And you know, and what frustrates me is we were told on a number of levels that BP would do everything that they had to do. I'm curious, what's your thoughts on what BP has done to this point?
BP gave the national news $100 million to be quiet, and they did. And I don't know what they did to the government or to the Coast Guard. I go back and forth between incompetence and being bought off. That's my opinion, and it's not worth anything, but I'm standing here in the middle of it.
So at the end of this, you're the one who's looking down the road, because benzene, everyone knows benzene's a carcinogen, and you know, one of the rings that down the road you may have cancer in your future.
Well, that's the thing. Feinberg came in and they haven't processed these claims correctly. They haven't even given us a formula for these claims correctly. He gave us three choices that in 30 days we might be able to get a payment. We don't know what that payment's going to be yet. Or we can take quarterly payments and keep giving more documentation. Or we can take $5,000 in cash or $25,000 for a business. So basically they're telling you that your life for one individual is worth $5,000. Because what's going to happen now is we don't have our emergency claims are not paid. So people are hungry. I'm not seeing homeless people at these meetings. They've lost their house. They've lost their cars. They've lost their livelihood. They've lost their culture. In some cases, because of the mental illnesses, stresses, they've lost their families. And now they get to choose to take $5,000 and maybe you can pay your mortgage and feed your family for a couple more months. Or you can worry about the fact that you're already sick, or you're not, but maybe 10 years down the road you're going to die. That is not a fair trade-off.
I don't think anybody should be put in that position, and this is one of those things where I think we as a society should be mandating that at the barest of minimums, that BP set up at least a fund for future health care costs. At the barest of minimums.
I think they need to help take health completely out of the equation. We can't come back and say that we don't have enough fish if we want to go ahead and take that option, but we can definitely come back and say that we need health care. And it would be great if just one of our congressmen would stand up for us enough to sponsor a bill, like you just mentioned, that would take care of our future needs as far as health care. But I haven't seen that to date, not even from our own state.
Well, here's the thing, Sheree, and this is the sad reality of our nation. Look how long it took the people that we called heroes after 9/11 to get health care.
And, you know, those guys are the best. They called us early on, maybe 2 months in, they called me, and we've still been working. We talked to John from the Feel Good Foundation, Richard Skinner, and we followed them all the way through on their health, their fight for health care. We supported them. We called, because we knew what they were going through now is what we will be going through for the next 9 or 10 years. And we were glad to see it go through. But I got to remind you, it was a hard fight, and they cut the amount of money in half, and they cut the amount of time in half, and those poor guys are due without any kind of health care for the next 3 months. I mean, you're right, this is what it's come to, and I was totally asleep to that fact, and I think many, many people are. But if it can happen in the Gulf, and it can happen to the first responders, and it can happen in Exxon Valdez, it can happen anywhere.
Absolutely. Here in Pennsylvania, where we're talking about doing a whole bunch of gas drilling here in the state, you know, these are the things that we've got to look at as well, because, you know, the people that we call heroes today, what are we going to be doing them tomorrow? And if this is how we treat those folks, who will be the next hero?
Look, I'm going to tell anybody out there in Pennsylvania, don't you dare go for that. When North Louisiana, we had that going with the fracking and all that, and I'm here to tell you that you can turn on your water and you can light a lighter or a match, and your tap will catch on fire. And it's because of that gas drilling. We have got to find a better way on this earth. We have got to stand together and demand that not only our government, but that each other, that ourselves be held accountable to what not only we're doing to this earth, but what we are doing to our future generations. Because you know why? Our whole life depends on it. The earth will go on, but the people on the earth shouldn't suffer for greed, and that is what's happening to my state, to my Gulf, to my family, and to my people.
I mean, I find it hard to believe that not one of your Congress people there in Louisiana will step forward for you.
Like, I can't say very much, but I can say maybe people want to look into donations and how much the oil industry has given to the congressmen of not just these states, but all around the states.
I understand Diaper Dave Vitter. I understand him not being
yeah.
But, you know, I don't understand your congressional representatives. Well, let me ask you this, Cherie. You know, as we move forward, you're the co-founder of Gulf Change. Do you have a website?
We have a website going up next week. We haven't got there yet.
Make sure you get that to us because we want to link that to our site.
Definitely.
But what can we do? What can people do to change things? What can we do to help out?
Well, I went to 5 Feinberg meetings last week, and at each one we asked the same thing, that they take health care out of the equation. So if anybody wants to call Feinberg and ask if that happened, that would be great. That would be very helpful. And also, contact the White House and try to get some help. Please contact the CDC and try to get some help. And there are a lot of good organizations down here that are helping people on Coastal Heritage Foundation. If it hadn't been for Coastal Heritage of South Louisiana, I wouldn't have had any Christmas presents for my kids this year, period. They helped us out. Also, Gulf Restoration Network, Louisiana Environmental Action Network gave us our blood tests, and they have been giving people blood tests for free and trying to share that information with the CDC. So I 100% support those three groups. Gulf Fund is another one. They're helping people on the ground with what needs to be done. We need money, and we need doctors, and we need attention.
And
to what's going on, you know, to what's happening, awareness.
And we need to take care of our nation.
Oh, definitely.
We as a people need to step forward and take care of this. I wish you nothing but the best.
Thank you.
I hope things move in the right direction. And
look, let me tell you something. We live in South Louisiana. Things are going to move in the right direction because I don't think they knew who they were messing with when they came down here. But we don't shut up here. Okay, we're not going to stop fighting. If I don't care what has to happen, I'm going to make sure that my people, to the best of my ability, and my family is not just healthy, but economically sound. We will fight for our state. We will fight for our Gulf. So so much appreciate your thank yous. I really need you guys everywhere in Pennsylvania, around the world, to join in this fight because clean air and clean water are a God-given human right, and they are violating our human rights in the Gulf of Mexico.
Amen, Cherie. Cherie Foytlin, co-founder of Gulf Change. We'll get that website at ours at therickssmithshow.com here in a couple of days. Cherie, thanks so much, and I'd love to talk to you again here in the near future.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're back after this.
Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You know you're in trouble when you're reduced to calling Dennis Hastert as a character witness. After all, when he was Speaker of the U.S. House, Hastert ran the place as a pay-to-play whorehouse, openly trading legislative favors for the campaign cash waved around by frisky corporate lobbyists. Who in the world would want Hastert to vouch for their ethical virtue? Tom DeLay, the former GOP majority leader and the one Congress critter who was even sleazier. Having been convicted last fall by a Texas jury for illegally laundering corporate money into some state legislative races, DeLay was back in the courthouse on January 10th for sentencing. Was Tom respectfully repentant? Come on, does a skunk smell its own stink? No, nothing is ever his fault. Even though he had also been reprimanded by his own colleagues for schmoozing with favor-seeking lobbyists and for commandeering a federal agency in one of his partisan actions against Democrats, he dismissed that come-up and says nothing but, quote, a warning ticket. Bad metaphor, since he clearly sped right through the warning. Now a convicted felon, DeLay blames Democrats for his, quote, persecution, even though the jury that found him guilty included Republicans and independents. At his sentencing, the closest he got to expressing contrition about his corruption was to admit that sometimes he comes off as arrogant. However, he even denied that his arrogance was bad, quickly explaining to the judge, I like to think of it as Texas cocky. How about Texas stupid? This is Jim Hightower saying, the judge was not amused by DeLay's insistence that he is the victim. Before there were Republicans and Democrats, the judge said, there was America, and what America is about is the rule of law. Pointedly noting that, I agree with the jury's verdict, the judge then sentenced Clueless Tom to 3 years in state prison and 10 years of probation. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got a bad case of putting it up. It's been cold in the heat, so fire it up. I got a bad case of putting it up. It's been cold in the heat, so fire it up.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I look at that scenario, and it to me, it's right in line with the folks in New York, the people who we called heroes. We patted them on the back. We applauded them. We put them on talk shows. We put them on TV, tell them how great they were until they got sick, until they needed our help. And then it was, sorry. I'm seeing that as the same kind of thing. These are the people who are out there cleaning up their neighborhood. They're the folks who are out there on the boats cleaning things up, out there with rags, out there pulling the booms in. And, you know, at the end of it, if we can't take care of these kind of folks, if we're not going to demand that the BPs of the world, fix the things that they destroy. Now, bring that here home. Bring that to our backyard. Because she did talk about the fracking, and she did talk about the gas drilling that's going on down there. And she did mention the fact that people's spigots, you can light them on fire. Bring that home. Bring it to our backyard. When these big drillers come in, when the big profit seekers come in, and I'm not against profit, but when they come in and they start sticking needles everywhere and they start pumping those chemicals into the ground, then what? Who's going to take care of the folks in this community? Who's going to make sure that your exposure doesn't kill you? And I look at this woman, and 2.5 times the 95th percentile, her ethylbenzene levels are through the roof. And, you know, maybe she's going to be a lucky one, and her body will react a little differently. But for the vast majority of people, from the stories that I've read, she's got cancer in her future. She has got cancer in her future. Now, you know, and listening to her, the fact that, you know, some charitable group had to bring presents so that they would have Christmas doesn't make me feel real secure in the fact that she's going to be able to afford health care. Doesn't make me feel real good about her prospects of living down the road without health care, because in this country, no job, generally no health care, and no health care, you die. And that's where we've put ourselves. And I bring it right back here, right to our home. Because if you don't think we're going to have these kind of problems, if you don't think we're going to see mass problems, because there's no help here in Harrisburg. I don't think there's going to be any oversight. I think we're going to be, again, reacting. Every time there's a major spill, every time there's a catastrophe, every time someone leaves a valve open, every time a truck goes down the road and spills its contents, who's going to be left to clean it up? We are. We're going to be the ones who bear the costs. So, you know, and it's one of those things, man.
And what about the fishing industry? I mean, we heard initially, oh, this is going to destroy the fishing industry. All of a sudden, the story disappeared. But you listen to stories and tales like her. Well, what about the fish? Is it going to be contaminated? There's probably a pretty good chance that's not probably the safest fish to consume. I mean, think
not here in Pennsylvania, it's much better.
Think of the economic impact. I mean, and then she talks about the marsh has already had huge amounts of oil in it. And according to what she's saying, it's now the oil that was pushed to the bottom is now coming on shore. Wow. And where's the story? Maybe that's the big story, that it's kind of no story at all. Have you heard any national news? Very, very little. It's kind of the story that went dead. Where is it?
Well, like she said, and I do believe this. The reality is BP put out an awful lot of money. They just dominated the airwaves with, we're going to make it right. We're going to make it right. Remember all that? Well, does it sound right to you? Because it doesn't sound right to me. Not at all. But again, you know, I look at this spill. Another reason that I'm in favor of a national health care. Here's the thing. If we had a national health care system, I do believe our government would be pursuing BP for payments into that system. I think they would have to, because they would then be on the risk. They would be on the hook for all of those people's medical procedures into the future. So I would hope, you know, being the person that believes in radical self-interest, that our government's self-interest would be to protect itself from the liability of this spill by mandating that folks, that they have to pay. What's going on now is the people who are suffering, the people who are bearing the brunt of this burden, are folks who don't have insurance. They're folks who are living at the margin to begin with, which is why I'm a firm believer in a single-payer healthcare policy. And now we're seeing, according to Associated Press and GFK, we're seeing a little bit of a shift in the approval or disapproval of the Obama healthcare bill. 30% of the people now have strong opposition to the bill. That's down. That's the lowest level since September of 2009. So we're seeing that come down. The poll found that 40% of those surveyed said they supported the law. 41% were against it. Now remember, just after November's congressional elections, that stood at 47% opposition, 38% support. So we're seeing it move a little bit. I'm curious what the heated rhetoric is going to bring. I'm kind of interested to see how this is going to bring. But interesting, among Republicans, the support for repeal has dropped considerably, from 61% after the election to just 49% now. So you're seeing a big drop there. Because I think people are going, you know what? They're starting to see what's in it. They're starting to lose more of their benefits, and they're going, hey, maybe we could use this.
No, I think there's one thing here maybe you're overlooking in the Republican vote. I mean, there's more and more people in the business community saying, hey, you know what? They got some good stuff here. I mean, we ran into one guy who was a businessman and said, hey, I don't know why they're demagoguing this bill. I cut my cost in half with the Reform Act. That's pretty good stuff. And you're seeing some business groups now coming out and saying, hey, repeal isn't the answer. That doesn't mean that they necessarily agree with all the changes.
I don't agree with all the changes.
But what they're saying is, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to start from scratch. It just doesn't. There's some good things in here, and it would be too expensive to start over. It just doesn't make sense.
But again, you know, you go back to this. You go back to this this health care. You look at the story there in Louisiana, and I'm telling you, it's going to happen here in Pennsylvania. For those folks at the margin, and you know, I'm looking at Pennsylvania and where this gas is at, where the drilling's going to go on. These are not the hotbeds of high wages and Cadillac plan healthcare plans. These are like this woman says, down in Louisiana, a couple of doctors, and most of them don't know how to deal with exposure. These are the kind of places we're looking at. You're putting something into an area where there's no knowledge base. You know, you go up into some of these very isolated areas where the gas is and where they're drilling. Do you think you're going to have endocrinologists who are going to be able to tell you what exposure you're going to deal with?
Well, I guess my question is, Rick, and maybe you know, what in this scenario, what is CDC's role? What is it supposed to be doing? Is it doing it adequately? You would think that somewhere along the line, given the huge problem that's going to be down there, you would think that the CDC would be crawling all over that area. What are they doing? Or are they doing anything?
Well, I don't know everything that the CDC does, but my understanding that they're basically a paperwork organization. They're not bringing doctors in by the truckloads. They're the ones. Their mission, I think.
Their mission is to educate.
Well, to keep track of things. They're the ones who track this stuff. That'd be interesting to find out. Maybe we should try and find someone from the CDC because this has opened up a whole new thought for me. Because if we're creating a situation in this state, like in Louisiana, where you're going to have these exposures and you're going to need some expertise, who's going to provide that? Where's it going to come from? When you have these mass exposures, where are you going to get the treatments from? And like this woman with this ethyl benzene exposure, her future is cancer. We know that. And how do you tell somebody how much going through cancer treatments is going to be worth to them? Like she said, $5,000, I guess, is how much a life is worth. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And if it were me, I would be hopping mad. What would you think? How would you handle this? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I'm curious. If you were someone who was sitting with 2.5 times the level of ethyl benzene in your system, 6 kids, how would you react? And what would you want done? We're going to take a quick break right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. The CDC's mission, and we were talking about it in the last segment, is to collaborate to create the expertise, information, and tools that people and communities need to protect their health through health promotion, prevention, and of disease, injury, and disability, and preparedness for new health threats. The CDC seeks to accomplish its mission by working with partners throughout the nation and the world to, one, monitor health, two, detect and investigate health problems, three, conduct research and enhance prevention, four, develop and advocate sound public health policies, five, implement prevention strategies, six, promote healthy behaviors, seven, foster safety and healthful environments, and lastly, provide leadership and training. So they're not a group that goes in and does. They come in, they try and organize stuff. So I don't know that the CDC would be really, the people on the ground, but they'd be the people creating the framework. And I think this is important, and we better figure this stuff out in a big way, because I do see problems down the road, especially as we start punching chemicals into the ground. I see it coming quite quickly because, again, there's talk that they're going to be cutting the DEP budget by the amount that the gas industry is giving the DEP. And you stop me to think about this. You're making the DEP, from what I've been told, and if you know otherwise, please let me know, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. But what I'm being told is they're going to pretty much make the whole Department of Environmental Protection reliant on funding from the industry. That, to me, not a good idea. Not a good idea at all. Anyway, have you been following the thing that's been going on in Arizona, the shooting and everything? I watched 60 Minutes the other night. And they have done everything they can do to make this guy out to be a crazy loon, and I don't know that I'm buying it. I guess my thing in this is the more people who tell me that he's crazy, the more I have to question it. And I thought the interviews were interesting. They kept having people say, oh, he's crazy, and how he went insane. I'm not getting it. And my mother-in-law, it was interesting. My mother-in-law, big Republican. She railing on about how the government has to protect us from people like him and how we should have had him locked up. And now remember, the Republicans are the anti-government people. And this is what always amazes me about them. They say, well, we need smaller government, but we need them big enough to take care of crazy people. And, she was, we had a family night last night, and she's raising her voice. And she was quite loud about it. Well, they should be protecting us. And she was very, very, as a matter of fact, and she was, kind of looked a little crazy to me. And I said, I better call and get someone out here because you're acting irrational. And I fear for my children, so we should have you locked up. Which immediately, which I should keep in the repertoire in the future. In the event that
did she catch what you were saying?
Almost immediately that I was going to have her locked up. That's what she took from it. But at the end of it, maybe there was some thought that went on there. And look, these things happen. But I loved that we need to keep us safe. And I've said before, I can keep you safe from outside threats. I can. But who's going to keep you safe from me? Because I know a bunch of people who I would characterize as crazy, that I would like to see locked up, that I don't go around, because I do think they're capable of shooting a bunch of people in a drug infested or drug crazed shooting spree, or just they woke up on the wrong side of the bed, or the guy a bunch of years ago who Bob Geldof wrote the song I Hate Mondays about, who just woke up one day and said, I don't like Mondays. I'm going to go shoot a bunch of kids at McDonald's.
We've always had this stuff. Are they insane? They're not right. Are we going to be able to protect ourselves from them? No. And this idea that now we're, and it's gotten nuts. They're talking about having congressmen carrying guns in the well on in Congress. They're talking about, oh, we should have all of the faculty in Arizona carrying guns on campus. Basically arm everybody. And what I thought was interesting is nobody shot the guy. Everybody had a gun. Didn't work. So you can have a whole bunch of people walking around with guns. Didn't work in this case. Now, granted, they tackled the guy because the gun jammed, but how many more people would he taken out had the gun not jammed? But now we're seeing in Arizona they want more gun law. They want more gun freedom. So I guess, the people down there, the gun nuts down there, they're not going to let a little shooting get them down. The Republicans in the Arizona state legislature, they're moving full steam ahead with several bills that would expand their gun ownership, which, I'm not against people owning guns. One bill, like I said, is going to allow faculty members of colleges and universities to carry concealed weapons on campus. I think only Utah is the only state that allows that to happen right now. And according to the National Conference on State Legislatures, 24 states have banned guns on college campuses. But, they want to go full speed ahead with that. Arizona Republicans are apparently also moving to expand open display laws, like the woman in Hershey there. I think she was from Hershey.
Lebanon.
Who had to have it on her. Had her on her hip there. Ah, the good
old
days.
Who got shot by her husband, by the way.
Ah, the good old days of the wild, wild west. Maybe they'll bring back duels. Who knows?
Apparently Annie Oakley couldn't defend herself when she got killed.
Well, I'm not going there with you, but, you do it.
But it happened.
Yeah, it did happen. And it's a sad testament, and the sad thing is again, there are more women killed by domestic violence. I don't want to get off into that. Another proposal would prevent landlords and homeowner associations from restricting the rights to bear arms, which, I got to be honest, the homeowners associations, I'm kind of in favor of. I don't think you should. If you own the house, you should be able to have whatever you want in your house. I'm not sure about landlords. But again, I'm sure gun people will call me and argue, and that would be okay, too.
I guess my question is, Rick, if I kind of asked it, if Arizona passes a law allowing guns to be carried on campus, can the campus themselves say we are going to prohibit it, or does the state law supersede?
Is it a private campus?
Most of them are.
No, most of them here in Pennsylvania, you got 14 state colleges.
Okay, so what you're saying is if it's state supported,
if it's a private college,
it can make up their own mind. Is basically
that would be my
saying.
Guess.
Well, they already asked the sheriff, and he said that would be a terrible idea, and I concur with that.
And a couple of the weird things that have come out of this. One of the guys who got shot threatened one of the Tea Party guys, ended up in a psych ward for a bit of time. He's now come and apologized. His sense came back to him. You look at this stuff, and there's just nothing good comes of it.
Well, what scares me is, and we are so divided. When you talk about sensible and common sense gun laws, all of a sudden, the NRA and the hardliners said, well, you're trying to take away my gun. No. I think at some point there has to be a realization that we have to have some common sense in these laws. I mean, just with the philosophy that, the bigger the better. I mean, that's just crazy. It just doesn't work. At some point, there has to be some reasonableness. And the problem I have with the NRA is not that it exists. I don't care if you belong to the NRA. But what I resent about the NRA, their philosophy is any law, no matter how much it's needed, no matter how much commonsensical it is, they oppose, simply because it's a slippery slope. Well, let me ask you something, Rick. If all the sides in this country on all the issues had that philosophy, we would never get anything done. We would never have any bills coming out of Congress.
There are some that argue we're not getting anything done now.
I that's what I resent about the NRA, that anything at all is just, you know, this, oh, the sky's falling and there go our guns. Well, you know, the NRA has been so wrong in some big issues in the last 10 years. I mean, and we don't have time to go into it, but that's what I have against the NRA. Not that it exists, but that it's really all the time when it comes to legislation, they're radical.
You've said, and you've made your point. The worst part of this for me, I think, is the fact that Representative Giffords could possibly lose her seat. If she's deemed to have vacated her office for 90 days, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer would schedule a special election, and she could conceivably, after being shot, lose her seat.
So you're saying after 90 days?
After 90 days, if it's been deemed that she's vacated her office. Now, I'm not sure what goes into that. This is a, you know, the Post had broke it yesterday. I'm assuming this is a designation by the governor, but we will see. So it'll be interesting to find out.
You know, all kidding aside, I've never thought of it, but you just brought up something. What would be the definition of fulfilling your obligation? Could you come to Congress in a wheelchair? What are the limits? I mean, we might be breaking some historical ground. Or what if she recovers in a year? Can they allow her that time? I mean, we're getting into some area here. You know, the governor might be right, but yet politically, that might be hard after 3 months. You might have a political outcry on that.
Well, it's part of their law. If you vacated office for 3 months, 90 days, they have the right to schedule a special election. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons. Lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. The Department of Homeland Security on Friday canceled a project to build a technology-based virtual fence across the southwestern border, saying that the effort, which has already spent $1 billion, was ineffective and too costly. Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary, said she had decided to end the five-year-old project known as SBI Net because it doesn't meet current standards for viability and cost effectiveness. In a statement, Ms. Napolitano said border agents would increase instead use less expensive technology using increased patrols that are already part of their surveillance equipment, tailoring it to the specific terrain where it will be scouting for illegal border crossers and drug traffickers. Now, you look at the money that we've spent on that, and you look at the money that we spent in Iraq, and you look at the money that we've spent in Afghanistan, and all of this money that we've just wasted. This fence that they wanted to build, it's talking about $7 billion to build a virtual fence, which one electric outing, that's the end of it. At some point, rational thought has to be part of this. You want to build the fence? I'm all in favor of it. Build a really big fence. Put people back to work. Anyway, I understand someone of great import to the nation passed away recently. We wanted to spend a couple of seconds talking about that and honoring him as he passes.
Yes, there was a gentleman by the name of Dick Winters. Some of you might have seen the TV miniseries. It was about a company in the 101st that went through the whole war together. Easy Company. It was a true story. Dick Winters came through the Normandy invasion. They went through Belgium. They went through France. They went through Germany. They were surrounded in the Battle of the Bulge of the Germans. They actually liberated the Dachau death camps. They were the first Americans to visit the Führer's Eagle Lair in Bavaria. He was a true American hero, was decorated several times. What I totally respect about him, he never felt, to the day he died, he never felt that he was a hero, but he said often that he was among men who daily committed heroic deeds. Very unassuming, self-effacing. And to show you what kind of man he was, he didn't want any pomp and circumstance. He didn't want a lot of publicity. And he was buried just with his family in a quiet ceremony. And he's indicative of a lot of people. He reminds me of people that I knew, you know, personally, my brother, the people that really went through the horribleness of World War II were very reluctant, at least in a sense, to put fame and fortune on their head. Were very reluctant. I know Dick Winters did sit down with the man who wrote a book about it and the movie, and they came out with this fabulously famous movie on TV. But I think it's very appropriate that we honor these men. I still think, and there's a lot of historians that agree with me, that they were in fact our country's greatest generation, and they're dying quickly. There's not that many of them left, and I say, you know, God rest his soul. He was a true, true American hero.
Oh, you're done?
Yes, yes.
I saw the story in the paper last week, and it was one of those things that, you know, you read about, and it's, you know, my generation, I don't think it's real.
Kind of a generation removed.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the history books, and you know, you talk about these things, and it's things that were on paper for us. at least the way I mm-hmm. read about it and the way I learned about it. But I think for your generation, it's a lot closer.
Well, if I can, Rick, I mean, to show you how great a military tactician he was, the story goes, and it's been backed up by eyewitnesses, that they ran into two reinforced German companies, 300 men. And he had, they had taken their lumps, and he only had about 30 men. And instead of running away, they attacked, and that day he killed and wounded over 100 of those Germans, and there was a bunch of them that got some very meritorious awards for that. That gives you an idea of what kind of a tactician he was. He was a great soldier, and he got a battlefield commission. And I didn't know this. He actually taught at West Point after the war. He stayed in the Army. He had a chance to get out. Stayed in the Army to the end of the war, and then eventually wound up at West Point, which I think is a great accomplishment for somebody who started as a non-com.
Yeah, it's an amazing story and part of our history.
And in fact, I had a friend who, unfortunately, the last years of his life, she was part of taking care of the man, and she said she had great respect for him. He was a wonderful, wonderful man.
And you know,
he was in his 90s when he died.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yes, he was in his early 90s. If you remember, I remember at Hershey when President Bush came here, he presented him at that rally that they had in Hershey. That was quite an honor for him. But unfortunately, you know, those veterans are dying out. But I think we have a responsibility to remember the absolute sacrifice. I mean, they saved this country.
And if you fast forward that to today, we should be taking care of the folks who are coming back today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I can see a mind change in World War II. Think of what we did for those people, Rick. I mean, and they should have. The GI Bill, and we talked about this. It was one of the reasons that we were so successful after the war economically, because we trained these people. We allowed them to go to college and to be the best they could be. And that whole mix of 6 million soldiers and sailors and airmen coming back from the war, and the GI Bill, and this great onslaught of educated men and women going into our economy was one of the reasons that we had this just economic explosion in the late 40s and early 50s.
That, and you had a whole bunch of people pumping out kids.
Well, yeah, it's called me. It's called,
Is that who I blame?
The generation.
Is that who you blame?
The biggest generation in the history of the United States. And here we are. Now we're starting to retire, and we're still providing jobs for people. I mean, the truth is.
Yeah, you're going to need a bunch of people to wipe your nose.
Well, hey, you know, if I was a young kid coming out of high school and college, I'd seriously consider going into the healthcare field, because you're not going to run out of patients, trust me.
Yeah, well, I can't imagine having to deal with you all day long. Anyway, but it's a good story. Glad you brought it up, and I hope that as you said, he does rest in peace. Anyway, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna talk about the Looney Channel, or the Learning Channel, sorry, which I think has turned into the Looney Channel. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We'll be right back after this.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Writers Guild of America East scored two victories last week when it won National Labor Relations Board organizing elections. Nonfiction writers and producers at Atlas Media and ITV Studios voted in favor of union representation.
organizing writers and producers for production companies can be a difficult endeavor due to many of the jobs being freelance or temporary. WGA East Executive Director Lowell Peterson spoke with the Workers Independent News on Friday to explain how such organizing drives are unique.
In this case, people are temporary at particular shops but tend to stay in the industry. So communicating with them is not so difficult as it might be in some other industries. You know, it's a large and flexible pool of people, but it's basically a defined pool of people. It's several hundred folks in New York City in particular, and there's some folks in other cities as well. But the other thing is we have, when we've done these NLRB elections, we've won the right to have people who are not currently employed at the particular shop vote in the election. If you've worked at the shop for a certain number of weeks, in some cases a lot of weeks, prior to the election, you're eligible to vote. And that is a recognition that we had to fight for, but that is a recognition that people do cycle through. And if you might work for an ITV in January and then not work for them for 6 months and then work for them again, and you have just as much interest in whether ITV people are unionized as someone who happens to be sitting at the desk today.
We will remember Dr. King and his dream, keeping it alive. It's about social and economic justice.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life while helping public sanitation workers in their struggle for union rights and dignity on the job. In Cincinnati Friday, hundreds of labor and community activists honored Dr. King's legacy in a candlelight gathering condemning Ohio Governor John Kasich's plan to strip child care and home health care workers of their rights to collectively bargain. AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker was at the Cincinnati event.
The real issue is we've got to put our people back to work. With 15 million people unemployed in this country and wanting to work, that should be the priority. But instead, we have these elected officials who have been elected with Wall Street's money, who are out there preaching on behalf of Wall Street, but not caring a darn about Main Street.
Holt-Baker says public workers are under assault nationwide, despite the fact that Wall Street, not workers, are to blame for the economic stress of state budget deficits.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Have you been following TLC? It used to be, called the Learning Channel. I got to be honest, it's looking more like the Looney Channel. You got Sarah Palin on there, and last night I flipped past it, and in the good pastor, Ted Haggard was on there. I guess he's got a new show called Scandalous coming on online. They're going to talk about, you know, the good pastor's life. You remember Pastor Ted Haggard, don't you, Jake?
Yes, I do.
The good pastor got himself into a little trouble, and, not a little trouble. He ended up getting caught sniffing crack off the backside of a male hooker, if you can call that a little trouble. But the problem was, is he's a guy who was the head of the National Evangelical Association. And, got busted. And, it came out that, he was actually, in fact, gay. While he's working to destroy gay rights, while he's working to pass the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, while he's working to do a whole bunch of things that are the antithesis of what he himself is practicing. So now he is, back on TV, starting a new ministry, which, good for him. What I find interesting about his story is how everybody in the Christian community dropped him like a hot potato. They kicked him out of his National Association for the Evangelicals. They kicked him out of his church. They ostracized this guy. I got a question. Christian values?
I'm not so sure. Other news in the sex times, Republican district attorney from Calumet County, Wisconsin, has resigned. He resigned after his sexting scandal. You know what sexting is? It's where, I guess they... You know,
texting with a sexual connotation.
There you go. Evidently, he's now saying that he's immune from any lawsuits in civil court. Ken Kratz says that he was a public official at the time that the alleged harassment occurred, and he has claimed absolute immunity and qualified immunity, both legal doctrines that shield government officials from certain cases from being sued personally. And I guess you could go after the office and sue them. But
is he saying that this sexting was in the commission of his duties? Is that what he's saying?
No, he's admitting he did it. Because he did. They got him busted. He's busted doing it. But he's saying that.
So he's hiding behind a technicality.
Absolutely. So he's saying that they can't sue.
And then people wonder why they disrespect the law.
Now, our good Republican prosecutor, he was prosecuting this woman's ex-boyfriend. All the while, and again, here's this woman who's being abused by her boyfriend and now being abused by the person who's supposed to stand up for her. Since this woman came forward, four other people have come forward as well, saying that Mr. Kratz made inappropriate advances to them as well. Yeah, just weird
and
stuff.
Are there any lawsuits pending?
Yeah, but again, this guy's trying to say I'm immune. And it's going to be interesting to see how the courts rule on this.
You got to give, and I know there's a lot of politicians that would do, but I got to tell you, I think the Republicans have the bigger kahunas. I mean, wow.
Yeah, well, it's interesting stuff. And you look over in Italy, Sergio Berlusconi, evidently he's gotten himself into a little trouble. Turns out, at least the attorneys over there are saying that he may have paid a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old to have sex with him, along with paying a significant number of women to have sex with him as well, which is, again, good for him, I guess. But this girl, 17, who was a belly dancer from Morocco, evidently, rumor has it that he did the deal. And if you remember last week, we talked about Lawrence Taylor doing some time there. I wonder what would happen to a sitting prime minister like Silvio Berlusconi, who owns the majority of the media in the country of Italy. He started off with a couple of radio stations, bought a couple of TV stations. I think he owns three or four of the seven TV stations.
Well, but isn't this the same guy that comes to public events with his lover?
No, that was the guy from France, Jacques Chirac.
Oh, okay.
That was Jacques Chirac. Okay. But speaking of Jacques Chirac, and I know you didn't mean it, but it's a good segue, because today, back in 1994, Paula Jones accused Bill Clinton of sexual harassment. She asked for $700,000 in damages. She eventually won in 1996. She won a couple of bucks, got the nose job, then went on to do a little.
And amazingly, she appeared in Playboy. I still remember.
And nobody bought it.
I still remember her testimony. She said, "A bail." She said "bail" about 100 times. I think somebody called her trailer trash. Not nice.
Yeah, but during that, during that whole impeachment thing that went on, which Clinton was acquitted for, Jacques Chirac had showed up to a state function with his wife on one arm and his mistress on the other. Just to kind of thumb their nose at us because we were hung up in it. And you go back and you look at this stuff and how much of the people's business didn't happen.
Oh, my.
Because we were obsessed with Lewinsky and Paula Jones and Jennifer Flowers and all the other less than attractive women that Bill was supposed to be fiddling about with.
But some of the second and third stringers in the Republican side, like Congressman Gaucus, he was in his glory. He was on national TV every night for a year. Not only did the Republicans not have to deal with the problems of the country, I mean, some of their substitutes, some of their second and third stringers Boy, they got all kinds of great publicity.
Well, they couldn't find problems. The economy was steaming right along. Clinton had a really high approval rating. The country seemed to be moving in the right direction. So they had to have something. You know, and if you can't complain that the economic policies are bad, you can't complain that people aren't doing well, you start complaining about nonsense.
I mean, if you think of what happened.
Nonsense.
When you think of what happened and then you compare it to what happened in Iraq, here you have Bill Clinton, who lied about sex out of marriage. Now, there's a first. And they impeached him. Said he lied under oath. And then you fast forward to the Bush administration that pretty much deliberately lied and misled us into a war. And where are the impeachment? Where are the charges? I mean, if you really sit down and you think about the common sense, it makes no sense at all. Where's the sense of balance?
Where's the justice?
Where's the justice?
And, you know, I blame the Obama administration. You look at this guy, J. Gerald Hebert. He was a former acting Justice Department chief who served the government's enforcement wing between 1973 and 1994. He's going, hey, we're setting a dangerous precedent here by allowing the Bush officials to get a get-out-of-jail-free card. Just, you know, we didn't allow all the Reagan people to get out of jail. They were indicted. They were convicted. A lot of them got off with slaps on
Ollie
the wrist.
Ollie North got off.
A lot of them get off on a technicality like Ollie. And the ones that went to jail, they didn't go to hard prison. They went to country clubs. But there was still that, hey, you know, we're going to hold you accountable. And I remember when Obama took office, there was this whole movement of his, oh, we're going to look to forward instead of looking back, and we got to dig the country out of trouble. And I'm going, if you remember, you know, there was this mentality, we need to let dead dogs lie. And as I said back then, dead dogs are still dead dogs. Somebody's got to pay the price. And you look at the fact that in Texas, you had House Majority Leader and former Speaker Tom DeLay, who the state of Texas had to go after. It was the state of Texas that went after him, not the federal government, who had him for a number of things, but didn't pursue. Not at all. They had him on a bunch of stuff, not a single charge, nothing. It had to take a state district attorney to go after him. And you look at Monica Goodling. How many people remember Monica Goodling?
Oh, I remember her. She's from Lancaster County.
Pennsylvania girl. Went to Messiah. Went to the hyper-religious school over there with the Regents. Under oath. Says, well, I didn't mean to break the law. Knew she did. Do you think they prosecuted her? No. Asked career attorneys, why do you want to serve George W. Bush? Knew what she was doing was wrong. Yet we didn't go after her. Not once. Ted Stevens. We didn't go after Ted Stevens. State of Alaska thought they were going to. We didn't. We keep giving all of these folks, just go ahead, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And I say, you know what? We need to be putting people in jail. John Ensign from Nevada. Why aren't we hearing anything about that? I believe Charlie Rangel should be up on charges. But none of that.
How about Valerie Flame case? I mean, there's a case that, wow.
Well, Scooter went on trial, and he was found guilty of something lesser, which really ticked off Cheney that Bush didn't pardon him. But
Even without the pardon, I don't think he served any time, did he?
He did a little bit of time.
Did he? Not much.
No, but, you know, at the end of this, it comes down to, I guess this administration maybe didn't want to deal with those problems, but at some point, don't you have to have the basic rule of law? And that's what frustrates me, that, you know, I like President Obama. He just doesn't seem to be hard enough.
Well, if you want to step back 10 years, why wasn't there more investigations done on the 2000 election? Wow.
Well, I mean, you know.
And there were some Democrats pushing him. And I still remember Al Gore. I still remember him. I was adamant against it. And wow. And look what we got.
know, if you can't get them to do it, then who are you going to get? But, you know, she went into this whole thing about caging. And nobody picked up on it. And if you wanted to pull in the 2000 election and the 2004 election, she really went through how Tim Griffith and the Republican operatives caged these votes in the whole process. You know, but I don't know. Do you think this defense? Listen to this defense. Do you think you and I would get away with this?
I know I crossed the line.
What line? Legal?
I crossed the line of the civil service rules.
Rules, laws. You crossed the law on civil service laws. You crossed the line on civil service laws. Is that right?
I believe I crossed the law lines, but I didn't mean to. I mean, I, okay. You know, it wasn't...
In reference to the U.S. attorneys...
Yeah. Well, that explains it.
I didn't mean to. Do you think the cop would pull me over on the way home for doing 100 miles an hour? I didn't mean to.
But why
I'm sorry.
Why didn't you just say that first and then all's forgiven? I didn't mean to.
That's not a good defense for you or me, but you know, evidently for her it was good enough because she's not in jail and she should be. But that's just part of the game, man. You and I, the folks at the bottom, we pay the piper. But, you know, our elites, not so much. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You know, I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know you're in trouble when you're reduced to calling Dennis Hastert as a character witness. After all, when he was Speaker of the U.S. House, Hastert ran the place as a pay-to-play whorehouse, openly trading legislative favors for the campaign cash waved around by frisky corporate lobbyists. Who in the world would want Hastert to vouch for their ethical virtue? Tom DeLay, the former GOP majority leader and the one Congress critter who was even sleazier. Having been convicted last fall by a Texas jury for illegally laundering corporate money into some state legislative races, DeLay was back in the courthouse on January 10th for sentencing. Was Tom respectfully repentant? Come on, does a skunk smell its own stink? No, nothing is ever his fault. Even though he had also been reprimanded by his own colleagues for schmoozing with favor-seeking lobbyists and for commandeering a federal agency in one of his partisan actions against Democrats, he dismissed that come-up and says nothing but, quote, a warning ticket. Bad metaphor, since he clearly sped right through the warning. Now a convicted felon, DeLay blames Democrats for his, quote, persecution, even though the jury that found him guilty included Republicans and independents. At his sentencing, the closest he got to expressing contrition about his corruption was to admit that sometimes he comes off as arrogant. However, he even denied that his arrogance was bad, quickly explaining to the judge, I like to think of it as Texas cocky. How about Texas stupid? This is Jim Hightower saying, the judge was not amused by DeLay's insistence that he is the victim. Before there were Republicans and Democrats, the judge said, there was America, and what America is about is the rule of law. Pointedly noting that, I agree with the jury's verdict, the judge then sentenced Clueless Tom to 3 years in state prison and 10 years of probation. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Yeah, we're going to sell it all off. Yes, every bit of it. Every state asset we're going to auction off. Fire sale prices. Sunday. We're going to sell off all the assets. And who's going to make the profit? Who's going to tell the tale? Our quote of the day comes from economist Robert Reich, former labor secretary under Bill Clinton. He said, quote, "The public is being sold a big lie that our problems owe to unions and the size of government and not to fraud and deregulation and vast concentrations of wealth." Robert Reich writes, "Obama's future is that he won't challenge this Republican narrative and give people a story that helps them connect the dots and understand where we're going. I'm going to tell you where we're going. We're going to a place where all of the state assets are going to be in the hands of private interests, and you and I are going to get screwed every day of our lives. That's reality." And, you know, you look at this budget that we're going to be talking about in the next couple of months, and this is going to be an ugly, nasty fight. They're talking about anywhere from $3 to $5 billion in a hole in what the budget's going to be able to afford between how much revenue we bring in and how much we need to spend to run the state. And I found this interesting little piece over at the little Tea Party think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation. There are five ways to cut $5 billion. So let's check and see what's on the auction block, shall we? Number one, privatize the state wine and spirit shops. They think, and now remember, you got Terzai running around saying we're going to get $2 billion. You got all the Republican establishment saying $2 billion. Well, the Tinky Tank, they're trying to be a little more reasonable. $1.7 billion, they think. They think they're going to get $1 billion in the sales of the license and $700 million for the buildings that we mostly lease, from what I understand. So $1.7 billion, don't think so. But, you know, that's what they're pushing. And we know that this asset of ours, the state stores, the wine and spirit shops, bring revenue into the coffers every year, year in, year out, reliable. We know that the workers are paid a decent wage. We know that every penny of the tax dollars that is generated in the state stores is in the state coffers. We know that. We know that on the societal side, the children aren't drinking alcohol. We know that there's a rational person behind the counter making sure that drunks aren't driving up and going, "Hey, give me a bottle." We know that. But they think, hey, one-time cash fix, $1.7 billion, I don't think you're going to get close to that. And the studies that they've used are flawed from the beginning. But even if you think back in 1996, you were going to get $600 million for the state stores. Even if you do believe that $600 million was the price tag back then, the economy in 1996 was a world better than it is today. So I'm saying you're not even going to get the $600 million you thought. Then they go on to their number two. They need to end corporate welfare, and I kind of agree with this. This economic development spending that makes special interest winners at taxpayers' and competitors' expense, I kind of agree with them on this. I just don't know that we're spending $1 billion on it. So, nice talking point. I'm in favor of stopping the handouts. But if we stop the handouts, and this is the pragmatist in me, if we stop saying, "Here, Harley Davidson, here's a boatload of cash," all those jobs leave. So if we can't do something on the federal level to stop states from doing that, it's just going to be our demise, which then would lead to less revenue and a whole bunch of other problems as well. So for me, not really sure, but I'm in favor of looking at the economic development thing. They want to reform Medicaid. I mean, they love taking pot shots at Medicaid. And I guess even Jack Wagner, Auditor General, has said that more than 10% of the spending in Medicaid goes to ineligible recipients, and they want to stop this. They think they're going to save $1 billion there as well. I'm not so sure. The numbers that they've come up with, a little hanky. My favorite one is this one. They want to redefine prevailing wage laws. They want to do away with inflated wages, inflated wage mandates for public construction costs that cost taxpayers 30% more than the market wages. They say they're going to save $1 billion plus. Now, you know, and just doing some real quick math, some real quick thoughts. In order to, if you're going to save 30% on your building costs, okay, if you're going to save 30%, and you're going to save $1 billion, so you're going to cut the wages of the workers by 30%. So if you were making $10 an hour, you're now making $7 an hour, right? 30%, right off at the knees. In order to save $1 billion doing that, construction costs are about 75% material, about 25% labor. In order to do that, you'd need an industry of about $12.6 billion on construction. Our budget's only $29 billion. We are not spending anywhere near $12 billion on construction. If I remember right, they were begging over 5 years for something like $3 billion to fix the roads and bridges. And that's not happening. So, again, I'm not sure where they're getting this idea. They love to pull that 30% out. But then I looked at their website, and there's 20% here, 30% there. I mean, it's indiscriminate. You know, they pull out a number, you know, wherever they can, generally out of the southern regions where the sun usually doesn't shine. And they just, you know, hey, who's going to challenge them on it?
Well, but they're blithingly forgetting another thing on the prevailing wage. That most of that money's going back into the community, you know, to support businesses, to maybe create some businesses who then pay taxes, who make the economy in that area a little bit better, which helps everybody, including the taxpayer. And they're just ignoring that. Their reasoning is pretty flawed on that issue.
My other favorite is they want to eliminate government competition with free enterprise. So we're going to eliminate government. And out of the free market, we will have people who either take on things or they won't. They want to privatize all state parks. They want to privatize all state-run museums. And they want to privatize FEA. They're the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency. They say that's a start. Somehow they're going to save $600 million by privatizing off the parks. So I guess, you know, all of these great parks that we have in the state, if we can auction those off for a couple of shackles, that will help over 1 year. And then you go, well, what about after that? Oh, well, nothing. You've just lost another asset. The museums, another asset. They really, and you know, understand, on the national level as well as on the state level, they're really ticked that the state has anything to do with education loans, especially on the national level, where big banks can no longer gouge for the rates that they were getting before. And FEA is another one. You know, they've been angry at FEA for years. Why? Because the for-profit interests can't gouge you to death.
Well, in fact, that was part of the cost saving of the health care reform bill. But yet, the Republicans are demagoguing. Why should government get involved? Well, maybe it's because taxpayers are getting ripped off, which is exactly the case.
And the one that I can't get, that I haven't figured out yet, they want to expand education choice for children. And they think somehow that's going to save them $500 million. And that's the one that's really perplexing because, you know, understanding the free market, don't you think those schools that are, you know, are charging $5,000 a year for tuition right now because they have to keep the tuition low enough so people can afford it, once you give someone an $8,000 voucher to go out and find those schools, don't you think immediately that $5,000 goes to $8,000 or at least over time? I kind of think that. Now, they want to talk about putting some language in. Good luck on that.
I guess my question is, now think about this through. You get the poor districts who, let's just say they lose 25-30% of their people, and they get to the point where they don't have enough income to operate. Some of the students who want to leave can't get in because these private schools who are getting our tax won't accept them. What happens to those students? What happens to those students at that point? We just kind of write them off, or are we going to divvy them up among other school districts? I mean, I don't think this is this has been very well thought through.
Well, the whole idea, the purpose is to destroy public education, not make it stronger.
At that point, what then? Do you want to privatize every school? Is that their ultimate aim?
No, the public school ends up... they're going to keep public schools. They're the ones who no one else can get... That's the last resort. That's the end of the road. That's the default. That's the fallback.
So if you in their world, if you want to get a good education, go to a private school. And those who just want to get by and get a degree and go on with life, they go to public schools. Kind of like a secondary education, or I should say a inferior education, which is basically what they're long term. That's exactly what you would have.
Yeah, I don't know that it's that. What I think it is how much we can profit. You know, how much money can we suck out of the system? That's what it's about.
But clearly, Rick, long term, and I know the Republicans are so fond of saying education isn't about money. But at some level, you have to have a basic amount to have a minimal level of education. It's not all about money, but money is a factor. Make no mistake about it. There is a direct correlation to some degree between the amount of money and the quality of education. And that's a fact of life.
I'm not going to argue.
And for political purposes, you can't ignore that. But that's what those who are advocating vouchers all too often do. They just ignore it.
Well, at the end of it, you can argue with this any way you want. It's about profiting off of education. It's about, you know, you look at Neil Bush when he started Ignite Incorporated. The people who, when I was in school, you'd mimeograph off a handful of tests, cost the school about 2 cents. They want to charge hundreds of thousands of dollars for proprietary information. But to me, 2 plus 2 is still 4 like it was back when I was a kid. Why do I have to pay Neil Bush to devise a test that says 2 plus 2 equals 4? Again, it comes back down to draining the system, sucking as much money out of it as you can. And look, I would love to have one school that was accountable. I would love to have school districts that you had the ability to, and I think you still do, and I'm still learning this process, because when I was in school, the smarter kids went into AP classes, college prep classes. Kids that, you know, were struggling to get by, they went on like a general path, and kids who weren't so bright in these fields went on into vo-tech. You found your way through this system, and at the end of it, you had something when you left. I think we need to strengthen that.
Well, we also had the business courses when I went to school. You either college prep, business, or trades, academic. I mean, general, we called it.
Same basic thing.
Pretty much.
But what we've done now is we've turned all that into big money. All those trade schools, you know, the vo-tech that we had when I was in school, that was right there in the building, is now a for-profit entity. It's all about who can profit off of what. And as we're moving in higher education, the more higher education we're seeing, the more privatization you're seeing, the more for-profit motive we're seeing. Is it better education? The reports I'm seeing say no. And in many cases, especially when you're talking about higher education, it's worse. But, you know, it is what it is, and it's a fight we're going to have to go through, especially here on the state level in the next coming months, because I think this voucher thing is first and foremost on the list. And it's something that, I honestly think we're going to lose. But we will see, because people are so hung up on this, I want to have choice. Well, that's okay if you have the actual choice. I'm not seeing you having a choice. Well, if you've got this magical piece of paper in your hand and nowhere to redeem it, do you have anything? And the answer is no.
Well, there's another factor here, Rick. The other side is doing a pretty good job demonizing teachers as all the whole problem. They're the problem with their education. It's the teachers' union. It's the teachers. It's the public school system. And who's chiefly responsible? Always comes down to the teachers.
Well, I like what my friend Cease tells me. You know, when she was hungry, they weren't making much money. Everybody loved teachers. As soon as they said, you know what, I don't want to have to depend on little Susie or Johnny to bring me an apple. I'd like to buy my own apple. That's when public opinion turned against teachers. And that's when, you know, you started seeing these big think tanks going after them.
It's easy to demonize.
Yeah, it is. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repairs.